Hello all, welcome back to the forum where science comes to socialize. I'm Aubrey and I'm joined today by my regular co-host Cleo.
Hey there. Wow, Aubrey, regular? I've never felt more special.
Oh, please. I'm making the distinction today because Cleo and I are actually joined by a guest co-host, Samantha Innes, while Daniela is off doing something fabulous in London. But don't worry, Daniela will be back with us on our next episode in 2 weeks' time. Anyway, Samantha is actually a former senior fellow at the Institute on Science for Global Policy. She's a current medical student at Drexel University College of Medicine, a go-to person on all things medical, and a close personal friend.
Aw. Hi, everyone. I'm so happy to join you on the forum. You know, it somehow feels like I've never fully left the ISGP.
Probably because you still pop up at our conferences and our publications and on our social media.
Speaking of, please let me do the honors. I've only listened to your social media intro about 3 million times.
Yeah, I'm sure.
You can communicate with us on Twitter using our handle at ISGPForum or by searching the hashtag ISGPForum. Or if you're like me and don't have a Twitter, you can find us on Facebook if you search ISGP's The Forum.
Wait a second. You don't have a Twitter? How can you even forum?
Nope. No Twitter here. And missing out on forum conversations actually kills me. I still love reading through the articles you guys post on Facebook and keeping up to date on all your podcasting progress, though.
Well, I have some good news for you. Even if you don't have a Twitter account, you can still read through all of our Twitter activity without one.
Even the live tweets from conferences I can't attend?
Absolutely.
Fabulous. Also, don't forget to subscribe to ISGP's The Forum wherever you find your podcasts. I know I am, and it helps me ensure I never miss an episode.
Well, it's clear that Sam's already a pro at spouting off info about our social media, so let's try her out on the content front and jump into the topic of today's episode, antibiotic-resistant bacterial epidemics. Sounds intimidating, but we'll break it all down for you, so don't worry.
So this podcast is based on a policy position paper entitled Surveillance of Antibiotic Resistance Gene Epidemics from our conference on Emerging and Persistent Infectious Disease, Focus on Antimicrobial Resistance. The program was convened by the ISGP in partnership with Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas.
The paper was authored by Drs. Thomas O'Brien and John Stelling, co-directors of the World Health Organization Collaborating Center for Surveillance of Antimicrobial Resistance in Brigham and Women's Hospital, Boston, Massachusetts. It was presented by Dr. O'Brien and subsequently debated by a number of experts at the conference.
Speaking of experts, what do you guys know about antibiotic resistance?
Well, I know originally new antibiotics were super effective and cured almost all bacterial infections, but over time something happened to bacterial DNA to make the antibiotics less effective.
Yeah, and these resistant bacteria have led to outbreaks that we see in the news, like MRSA.
You mean methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus.
Exactly. Like many things in nature, bacteria have evolved over billions of years, which has made them both diverse and numerous. Only a tiny fraction of bacteria can actually infect humans, but these few have caused an incredible amount of suffering and death. Then, around 80 years ago, we began making antibiotics. These antibiotics could enter the tissues of infected patients, kill any bacteria within the tissues, and cure any infections caused by the bacteria.
And for context, according to our authors, no drug is ever likely to save as much life as penicillin did in 1943.
Quite the claim.
Whoa. Aren't you allergic to penicillin, Sam?
Super. Once I got a penicillin injection before a music festival and sprouted hives everywhere. And I mean everywhere. And then I had to get a steroid injection in my buttocks in the middle of the concert venue's hospital tent, and it was quite a mess.
Sounds terrible, and likely too much information.
Ooh, sorry. Needless to say, there are some definite downsides to antibiotics, and one of them is allergies. Another downside is that over time, antibiotics fail to cure more and more infections. This is because bacteria have become resistant to said antibiotics.
You mean that the antibiotics become no longer effective in killing the bacteria due to some change in the bacteria's genes. That thing I already said.
Exactly. Essentially, an antibiotic kills a bacterium by binding to some target site within the organism, effectively blocking an essential function at that site. For example, penicillin is a cell wall synthesis inhibitor, meaning it leads to the creation of leaky cell walls when the bacteria are reproducing. Without a functional cell wall, new bacteria can't be formed and an infection cannot spread within you. Eventually, the lack of new infectious bacteria plus your robust immune system causes your illness to subside.
But how did they suddenly become so resistant?
Well, it hasn't been so sudden. A strain of bacteria becomes resistant to an antibiotic by acquiring a gene that keeps the antibiotic from functioning. Kind of like a tiny shield or Patronus, preventing the antibiotic from binding to the bacteria's target site. If the antibiotic can't bind, it can't do its job of stopping the bacteria.
Nice Harry Potter reference there.
Didn't you name an entire episode after Harry Potter? I needed to sneak at least one reference in.
Fair enough.
Well, good job doing so. So you've mentioned resistance genes. Where do these genes come from?
A strain of bacteria may get a resistance gene from a spontaneous mutation while it's dividing, or through gene transfer from another strain of bacteria.
To clarify here, spontaneous mutations are errors in the DNA code that happen naturally and change the code for better, worse, or not at all. In reference to the second method Sam mentioned, genes can be transferred between different bacterial strains via plasmids, or tiny transferable bits of DNA. That one's genes transfer.
What I don't understand is this. From what you've said, resistance should have been acquired spontaneously in the past. Why all of a sudden are we struggling with antibiotic resistance now? Is it because we give farm animals antibiotics all the time?
Kind of. That's the interesting thing about antibiotic resistance. It's only beneficial if the bacteria that are resistant are exposed to the exact antibiotic they're resistant to. Consider this. When a resistant bacterium lands on a person, it's, say, 1 in a million of the person's total bodily bacteria. So it only has, like, a few in a million chance of becoming the bacteria that the person transfers to the next host. But if an antibiotic kills all the person's other bacteria, the resistant bacteria will multiply exponentially, as will its chances of getting to the next host. Obviously, the more antibiotics we're exposed to through treatments or food sources, the more likely this is to occur. In fact, many resistance genes would have disappeared or been too rare to notice if they hadn't been amplified due to selection by widespread use of antibiotics.
A prime example of too much of a good thing being no good.
Totally. So a gene expressing resistance to an antibiotic isn't noticed until after the antibiotic has been used for years?
Precisely.
Well, that's super frustrating that we've basically been in an arms race with bacteria for the past 80 years.
Probably even longer than that. But yeah, that's when we started using antibiotics. And at first, it worked really well. But like I said before, over time, the bacteria have become resistant faster and faster, and have even become resistant to multiple drugs at once. An example of this is the recently discovered New Delhi M1 gene, also called NDM1, which is now making infectious bacteria resistant to all effective antibiotics.
No!
Yes. In worse news, the strain has now spread from its origin in India to multiple other countries.
Faster methods of transportation, more people traveling, and medical tourism have all increased the spread of bacteria's antibiotic resistance. Types of resistance that were once regionally isolated are now popping up all around the globe.
I'm definitely guilty of contributing to that. I went from the US to New Zealand to Fiji and back.
I've been to Indonesia.
And I've followed the San Francisco Giants to the moon and back. Just kidding. But I did spend an entire winter in Costa Rica on a field research study abroad trip while in undergrad, so I guess we're all guilty.
Well, that's a sobering thought. So what else did the authors discuss?
Well, they noted that efforts to control antibiotic resistance have not adapted to the epidemic-like spread of this resistance phenomenon. While caregivers at the local level make efforts to track and contain resistance in individual hospitals, there is lacking tracking at state, national, or international levels.
I'm guessing that means the public health agencies traditionally responsible for detecting and minimizing epidemics lack data for tracking resistance at this time?
You'd guess right. Yet, an abundance of data are already collected at the clinical level that could be utilized for surveillance of resistance.
Laboratories worldwide determine characteristics of infectious bacteria daily with biochemical and antibiotic tests, and they're now genotyping more strains. But the reports only go to the requesting clinical staff. New informatics could enable us to aggregate, integrate, and search this data on web servers to find outbreak events, trends, and epidemics in real time, and even alert pre-designated responders automatically. And our authors believe that this is what we should be doing to reduce delays in outbreak response and to protect the effectiveness of our antibiotics.
So that answers another important question: who pays? These reports, which are already paid for, contain everything we can know about the kinds of bacteria, their antibiotic resistance, which patients they're infecting, and where we think these bacteria may be heading next.
The authors of the paper mentioned that the antibiotic resistance genes, as well as genetic elements and strains of bacteria carrying them, have emerged and spread through a succession of antibiotic-driven global epidemics. Can you think of any specific examples?
Sure. Penicillin-insensitive pneumococci first appeared in South Africa before spreading in Europe a decade later. Methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus.
MRSA.
Your fascination with MRSA today is slightly alarming, Cleo.
MRSA circulated for a decade in Europe before first being seen in a few United States hospitals and then moving out into the community.
And didn't vancomycin-resistant enterococci, or VRE, appear in animals in Europe first?
Exactly. Cleo, your animal knowledge never fails to impress me. Although I suppose I shouldn't be too surprised considering the amount of time you spent on farms. In any case, VRE then became widespread in intensive care units in the US and later in many other countries.
Our authors pointed out that recognition of successive epidemics of antibiotic resistance genes has been delayed and chances for early detection and containment have been lost because potential observers, mostly based in separate hospitals and with few surveillance tools, see only bits and pieces of epidemics and communicate primarily through publications in scientific journals.
Ouch. And as we all know, it can take a long time to get research published in a journal. I can see how that would slow things down significantly.
The authors also mentioned that genotyping and genome sequencing have enabled precise identification of genes expressing resistance to an antibiotic, and as a result, have allowed for more accurate tracking of the epidemics of each gene. Sam, why don't you do the honors and explain to our listeners the difference between genotyping and genome sequencing?
I'd love to. Genotyping is the process of determining which types of genes an individual possesses. Remembering that individuals can receive one copy of each gene from each parent, the question becomes, are both pairs the same? Homozygous. Are they different? Heterozygous. And genotyping paints the general picture of what each gene is destined to do. Sequencing is a method used to determine the exact sequence of a certain length of DNA, literally the A's, T's, G's, and C's that Aubrey, Cleo, and Daniela have described to you all before. You can sequence a short piece of DNA, the whole genome, or even only the functional parts of the genome called the exome. I like to think of it as different versions of the same story. Although the Hans Christian Andersen version and the Disney version of Little Mermaid are the same type of story, there's a mermaid in love with the human, she trains her voice for legs in the hope of him loving her, blah, blah, blah. The actual words are very different. Thus, sequencing is much more specific than genotyping and can result in some unique findings. So, how did your authors plan to create such a well-connected epidemic tracking and informatics system?
Well, they believe that all levels of public health, infection control, and patient care should coordinate their responses to global resistance epidemics. To do this, they suggested using global public health funding to develop and deploy shared automated informatics to integrate the surveillance and alerting required by these healthcare organizations.
Our debaters had some concerns, though. They pointed out that sharing data and analysis information among countries has proven problematic in the past due to economic and security concerns.
I could see why that would be a worry. I'd be less inclined to vacation to a tropical oasis where a deadly outbreak was occurring, and I could imagine how that would economically hurt a country.
Despite this, they also noted that the sharing of such information is critical to the success of any disease surveillance system. So, solutions our debaters discussed included communication of information in ways that appropriately recognize the wants and needs of specific audiences, practical incentives, mandates, and even policing tactics.
Wow, they run the full range from carrot to stick there, huh? I imagine policing could cause a lot of trouble in and of itself, such as cost and who's in control. I'm glad I'm not in charge of setting that up.
Which is why our debaters propose that a policing system could be established either, you know, through the World Health Organization, WHO, or another United Nations agency. Basically, organizations that are comfortable with global mandate enforcement.
They also recognized that mandates and incentives might not solve data sharing issues in less affluent countries, though, where many systems are paper-based. But the thought is that if more wealthy nations set the tone, less wealthy nations will follow when they can.
Using informatics, they projected that tracking the spread of infectious diseases could be improved at an exponential pace. And beyond that, they believe that systematic efforts to enhance, extend, integrate, fully analyze, and then use such surveillance data would be the most cost-effective component of any initiative to control antibiotic resistance.
As the great April Ludgate from Parks and Rec would say, time is money, money is power, power is pizza, and pizza is knowledge. Let's go!
Aw, April's my spirit animal, especially when she says that dogs should be rewarded for not being people.
Not so fast. There's a lot of work to be done before we go all April Ludgate on the situation.
What do you mean? Your author said it themselves, genotyping of resistant bacteria is increasingly being reported.
But rarely related to the context of local resistance outbreaks. To fill these gaps, we need traditional surveillance for epidemics by public health agencies plus someone or something to oversee, respond to the information, and coordinate containment for these regions.
Okay, so until now, these agencies have lacked the data for such surveillance and response, but newer informatics can now provide this data. Easy peasy, or pizza.
No, no pizza. Sam, let's start at the beginning. Define informatics.
Can you use it in a sentence?
Good morning. That's a nice informatics.
I'm starting to see what you guys mean.
Yeah, our debaters realized that they had to define informatics before anyone could, you know, create informatics. Is it just acquisition and storage of data, or will analysis also be involved?
While there was agreement that analysis ideally must be included in the system design, at the initial stage, storing data would be given priority. Rome wasn't built in a day, people.
So even if certain fields initially are not included because of cost or time factors, they can be created in the future for data acquisition and to reflect changing interests and priorities.
Si, senorita.
That's good. As a future doctor, I would be more inclined to participate in a system that had the potential to directly impact my patients. And I'm sure hospital systems would feel the same way.
Many of our debaters agreed that an element of direct benefit for patient care needed to exist. They questioned, you know, if a system didn't benefit individual patients, what would be the actual incentive for physicians to share?
Which is where the discussion returned to carrot or stick. In some cases, it's been mandatory for clinicians to report laboratory results to infection control organizations or other oversight institutions. It was argued that these mandates were the only reason a clinician would be compelled to report findings. But ideally, mandates wouldn't be required because reporting would be automatic. The software would deliver the pathology report to the clinician and the server at the same time.
Additionally, it was argued that the proposed system is not intended to be an element of individual patient treatment at first, but rather for international surveillance purposes designed to prevent the spread of resistant and non-resistant pathogens by observing patterns in distribution.
Sure. However, this doesn't prevent these data from being used for different types of analysis at an individual level.
Of course, it goes without saying that varied audiences have different needs for the type and presentation of data they would be interested in. However, a large database would likely produce too much data for individual analysis, so the solution would be to create algorithms to reduce the complexity of the data so users could make informed decisions without needing detailed knowledge of the statistical models.
As someone that has taken a medical school statistics course, I personally thank you. We learn enough to allow us to be informed practitioners of patient care, but we are by no means experts.
Well, don't thank us. Thank the debaters. They thought of pretty much everything. It was suggested that a new kind of expert is needed to meet the extreme data challenge a global surveillance system would create. Ideally, these experts would not just understand the statistical and scientific sides of these biodefense issues, but also how to manage international relationships between countries.
A suggestion was offered that, in addition to receiving the benefits of the proposed system, free training and education would be provided to create experts from within a country, but only upon agreement to share critical disease surveillance information. Because of the security and training aspects of the proposed compromise, it was argued that this would also help garner funding for a broader network.
I mean, how much funding do you need? The reports are already being paid for, remember?
Just think of developing nations and how they would participate in such an endeavor. Sure, the US and other developed countries have a decent number of systems in place already, albeit incomplete ones.
These systems only gather data on biothreat agents, such as plague or anthrax, but include data from animals and other organic samples in addition to humans, as well as GPS data.
But this isn't necessarily true globally, despite the need to have just as accurate information in Africa as is Europe, for example.
The Gates Foundation established a program to build microbiological capacity in less affluent countries through developing basic capabilities and providing training for operators. Many countries observe what the US does and then view these approaches as either too complex or too costly to implement in their own settings.
As a consequence, these countries might choose a simpler model that can provide laboratory reports at an individual level or by case-by-case basis, while still serving as a sentinel for global resistance surveillance. These simpler methods and systems could perhaps later be included in the larger proposed surveillance network.
If standardization of information, or as close to it as realistically possible, is the goal, then who sets the standards? Because even your authors noted that there has been limited success with retrieving information from separate electronic medical record databases in the healthcare field, because software programs are needlessly incompatible with each other. And the authors believe that if standards had been established earlier, this lack of compatibility would not be the problem as it is at present.
Debaters suggested that the system should run in accordance with the existing international health regulation standards, although it was noted that regulations would likely need to be modified to remain competitive with advancing technology. Policy in this regard needs to evolve from a working model established first to prove the worth and effectiveness of the system.
Like a dress rehearsal?
More like a tech rehearsal. Anyway, a possible pilot program of a global network system with maybe 100 laboratories participating initially was proposed as a proof of concept. With live updating as an open source, such a system would foster growth and development of analytical methods as different users prompted the system for alerts and reports. Database observers could also learn what kind of data users regularly demand to provide more automatic algorithms.
So, if your debaters ruled the world, or at least the world of epidemic informatics and tracking, the utopian system they would create would be a web-based, centralized, global surveillance system designed to allow sharing of microbiological data, including automatic software updates, automatic aggregation of data, and more rapid output.
That's the idea.
Affirmative. And that's about where we leave it for now.
Well, thanks, Sam, for coming on to help us navigate the exciting topic of antibiotic resistance genes today.
It has literally been my pleasure. Thank you both for having me.
Well, if you'd like to hear more from the Institute on Science for Global Policy's past and future conferences, don't forget to join us on Facebook, subscribe to our podcast, ISGP's The Forum, on SoundCloud or iTunes for instant downloads of our upcoming episodes, and find us on Twitter, even though Sam won't be finding us on Twitter, at ISGP Forum, or by searching the hashtag ISGP Forum.
Speaking of Twitter, let us know what you think about global surveillance of antibiotic-resistant bacteria. Do you have suggestions on how to fund or run such a program? What about feedback regarding obstacles you foresee? We love to hear your suggestions, so be sure to hit us up online.
Thank you all for choosing to socialize with science today. We'll catch you next time, right here on the Forum.
The Institute on Science for Global Policy, or ISGP, is a nonprofit organization that convenes international meetings bringing together scientists, policymakers, industry leaders, students, and other stakeholders to discuss pertinent scientific issues facing society. The ISGP has no opinions and does not lobby. Therefore, the preceding podcast reflects the views expressed by the presenters and debaters at our conference. For more information, please visit our website at www.scienceforglobalpolicy.org. Thank you.